Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
What do you get when you take a seasoned sociologist and a senior research associate, put them in a rented Dodge Charger for 6 weeks, and tell them to find some academic enlightenment? You get a religious road trip, that's what you get. And their fun-filled and educational trek of nearly 7,000 miles across the United States is the subject of our podcast today. The two scholars of which I speak are Roger Finke, who is a professor of sociology and religious studies at Penn State University, and Christopher P. Scheidel, a senior research associate in the Department of Sociology at Penn State and an adjunct assistant professor at the College of St. Benedict, St. John's University in Minnesota. The book that they wrote based upon their travels was recently published by Oxford University Press and is entitled Places of Faith, A Road Trip Across America's Religious Landscape. Now, Professor Finke has appeared on our show before talking about religious persecution, and for that reason, I decided to direct my questions today to his scholarly sidekick, Chris Scheidel. I should note that a link to this book, as well as Roger's previous interview, can be found at our website, www.researchonreligion.org, where you can also access our extensive archives, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes at no charge, yes, you heard that right, it is free, and also sign up on our Facebook fan page to get updates about what we will be doing on this show in the future, including plans for our 100th episode, which will be coming in late March. And please do tell your friends and colleagues about us because, you know, we enjoy the company. Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
I didn't provide my usual extensive introduction to this podcast because your book with Roger is truly unique. In fact, it might be the most unique book I've featured on this show, perhaps rivaled only by Chris Bader's work on Bigfoot hunts. And you guys know Chris Bader, too, by the way.
Yeah, we're all pretty good friends.
Okay, so I'm going to have to work him into the show because he's one of my favorite scholars and just a great guy, too. But before we discuss what you wrote about regarding your journey, I want to find out how you guys were able to do something like this. This is not your typical academic research project. I mean, what you did, you rented a car, you filled it up with gas, you pointed it in a direction, started driving, and then you wrote a book. I mean, how did you come up with the idea to do that? Were you guys just goofing around at first and say, hey, we could actually do this, or did you take it seriously from the start?
A little bit of both. It became more serious as we went along. I'm not really ashamed to say that this whole thing began with us drinking a couple beers one day, one afternoon. And I had this idea about, I'd always been really interested in kind of roadside religious messages and memorials and things like that that I've always seen just growing up, whether it's something spray painted on a bridge or a little shrine on the side of the highway, things like that. And I had this idea, well, you know, could we go out and just drive and take pictures of these things and somehow tell a story about American religion? And so the initial idea, we were sitting around one day drinking these couple beers, and I said, hey, Roger, I have this crazy idea. We should just go and drive and take pictures and see what we find, and then tell these interesting stories. And then as we spoke more, I really didn't think that he would, although I was somewhat serious, I didn't think he would take the bait. And sure enough, a day or two later, he comes back to me and says, I spoke to my wife, and she said I should do it, so let's start talking more about it.
Wow.
And then that eventually developed into us getting in the car and going a few months later. So,
okay. One of the things I should note, you mentioned that you took photographs of this, and this book, more than any of the other books we featured on our podcast, filled with photographs, beautiful photographs, color, some of them black and white. You use some historical maps in here. It's a really great read for anybody just interested in getting a flavor for what religion is like in the United States. And, you know, again, it's a really fun inductive academic endeavor where you just say, hey, let's find out what's happening and shoot some pictures and talk to some people. So it's really neat. Who is the main photographer?
Primarily me. Roger did have, we both had cameras, and so I think most of the shots that are in the book were mine, and I was the primary photographer, but sometimes Roger got some things that I wasn't able to get for various reasons. So
not only are you a published author, you're a published photographer.
Right.
And
yeah.
I feel the same way. My two books have my own photos on the cover of them, ones that I took. So I always feel, you know, doubly proud of myself when I talk about that stuff.
Yep.
So
from the very beginning, that was a big requirement, I guess, for us in what we ended up publishing from this, is that we always intended that it should have photographs, because as we began to get a little bit more of a better idea about what we were doing and why we were doing it, we came to realize that a lot of books that are trying to give an overview of American religion are organized in one of two ways. You have some books that are very chronological and just try to give a history from start to finish,
mm-hmm.
and then you have a lot of books that are more theologically organized, so each chapter may cover a specific group, and maybe within that chapter it goes chronologically or not. And as we talked, we said, well, you know, both of these methods, although they're very understandable, they really disembody religion from its place in communities, and we wanted to be able to show this geography of religion, and the only way you can really show that is through visual images. And so it was always a key criteria for whatever we published that it would have photographs in it.
Well, did you approach Oxford University Press or some other presses beforehand and saying, hey, this is what we want to do, and we want to put photographs in it? Because I know publishers, especially academic publishers, are always leery about putting in photographs because it increases the workload and the cost of the book, et cetera, et cetera. And your book, by the way, is in paperback and very reasonably priced, so I urge people to get it. But did you talk to Oxford about this and say, hey, we're going to drive around the country, would you like to publish this?
That would have been a good idea, but no, we actually just kind of gambled and took it on faith, if you will, that someone will publish this.
Yeah, well.
And I think, you know, we even had talked about this, about being worried about whether or not any publishers would be willing to do it because of fears of cost and things like that. And ultimately, we just said that worst case scenario, that no one wants to publish it as a book, and so we'll just make it some kind of ebook and put it for free on, I don't know if your listeners know the ARDA website, but we would just put it on that website and people could get it from there. So
my listeners should know the ARDA website. We've featured it a couple times, and we again will put a link to it for those of you interested in American religion and even world religion. It's a great resource for getting information and data about religion, probably the best one-stop shopping place that you can get for it. So we definitely will link to that. So Oxford picks it up. Great. My next question is, how'd you fund this? Do you guys get a grant, or you just, you know, do a car wash and head out?
Actually, Roger, he had some research funds. I'm not sure if it was just something that he had gotten when he came to Penn State or not, but he was able basically to bankroll it through some kind of research funds that he had through the university.
Oh, okay. That's good. So, because, I mean, what you're talking about, you're renting a car here and you got to stop at hotels and places to eat and all that kind of stuff. Did you guys, before you set out, did you have a specific plan for places that you wanted to visit, or did you just randomly spin a compass and say, hey, wherever it points, we're going?
Well, the initial idea when we first started talking about this was we really would just go and drive, and I don't know, just roll a dice to determine which highway we would take or where we would go. But then after talking about it, we realized, or feared, I guess, that we would get back and we either wouldn't really have anything, or we wouldn't have anything that was coherent enough to really tell a story. And also, just from a practical standpoint, that if you're driving on highways, it can be difficult to spot things, and if you do spot them at 70, 75 miles an hour, that it becomes kind of a hassle to exit and go back and try to find it again. And so
we
basically determined that we needed to have at least some kind of plan or some kind of anchors in the trip that we would use to organize the trip and eventually organize the book itself.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we wanted some spontaneity. So we didn't And sometimes this became a problem, but we didn't, schedule interviews or schedule meetings or anything like that beforehand. We decided upon particular cities and went to those cities, and then from that point on, made it somewhat spontaneous. So.
Okay, and then you just showed up at some places and say, "Hi, we're here. We're two academics, and we want to talk to you." I mean, did you ever get anybody looking at you like, "What are you guys, crazy or something?"
Yeah, we You know, I will say, before I give you the bad part stories, I'll say that, you know, most people are surprisingly generous with their time and surprisingly open to people who step on their door unannounced and want to take photographs and interview them and things like that. Most people were very open and welcoming. There were some cases, and understandably, that people were a little suspicious of what we were doing and who we were. Usually, we had the most problems the larger the church or congregation that we were dealing with, or kind of the more bureaucratic their structure was often the more difficult cases. I think the funniest part was we were in a mega church that I'll leave unnamed, but basically we got, instead of the person who we wanted to interview coming out and speaking with us, we got the armed security guard that was sent to us to escort us away. So,
oh, that, you said that's the funny part. What were the bad part? What was some of the scariest moments? Do you have any of those?
Scary. Well, not with any churches. Uh-huh. There was one time in Memphis that we were originally on Beale Street, which is a little bit of a touristy area. And we decided, okay, well, let's go off Beale Street and see what we can find. And it turns out if you go a couple blocks off the touristy part, it's not that great of part of town. And we shortly became friends with, I think it's probably safe to say, a couple that were probably had some kind of drug problem. And,
mm-hmm.
And they sort of were hassling us about giving them money and things like that. But, you know, nothing too terrifying. So.
Okay. So here's my next question. You're driving across the country. You picked a Dodge Charger. Why not an RV or an SUV or maybe one of those little smart cars?
I don't think there was actually much of a choice. We rented the car through Penn State's Fleet Services car rental service, and I think they just gave us the Dodge Charger. I'm not sure there was a lot of options.
Okay.
It also, sounds good. It goes back to the old, the Starsky and Hutch kind of days.
Yeah, no, you get a 68 muscle car, V8 engine. You guys are cruising and, doing the spin outs and donuts and stuff. That'd be kind of cool if you had video of that. I don't know. You should have actually asked for a sponsorship from Dodge. You could get on one of those Super Bowl commercials like, hey, two sociologists on their trip to find religion throughout America buy the new Dodge Charger. That would have been cool.
We actually talked about, just jokingly about sponsorships because we ended up staying in Comfort Inns for the most part almost every night, every time we stopped. And they really should have been the main sponsor of the trip.
All right. The last question I have before we actually start talking about what you actually did on your trip and some of the places you went was about your families. Now, you mentioned Roger had to get clearance from his wife, and he has a couple of adult-age kids now who are off in college and their careers and stuff. So, yes, he had some freedom to do this, but what about you? You're younger. What was your status here, and did you need ground clearance to do it?
The woman who would eventually become my wife now is actually, at the time, she's a psychologist, and she was actually in Salt Lake City doing an internship for her degree. And so she was away anyways, and so I was fairly free at the time to do it as well. So
actually, I have to ask a question because I don't remember reading this in your book. When did you guys do this?
This was in 2008. I think we started in mid to late May and went through late June.
Okay. All right, so that gives us some kind of timeline. So late spring, early summer of 2008. All right, so let's get you in the car here. You throw your bags in the trunk. You're getting into the car. You point the car south, and your first major stop is Memphis, Tennessee, home of Elvis. Now, why did you choose Memphis first? Any particular part of Memphis interest you guys?
Well, we knew, you know, as we decided that we needed some anchor cities to organize the trip, we knew that we wanted one of them to tell the story of the relationship between race and religion in the United States. And I think it's obviously no secret to anyone that race has played an important part in U.S. history. But what I think a lot of people don't necessarily always appreciate or know about is how race has played a role in kind of the religious landscape of the United States. And so when thinking about, well, what city could represent and to help us tell the story, we ended up settling on Memphis because it's, I don't know if you want me to go into all the details now, but it has several features that make it really important in the history of the Black Church.
Well, tell us about those. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, it's the headquarters of the Church of God in Christ, which is the largest Pentecostal African-American denomination. Furthermore, it has served an important role in the Black Church's function or influence in the Civil Rights Movement historically. So Martin Luther King Jr. gave many speeches there in churches, in Black churches, and was eventually assassinated there. So we thought we would help us tell that part of the American religion story and the role of the Black Church. And furthermore, it's obvious you mentioned Elvis Presley. The Black Church has had an important influence in popular music, and so Memphis is a home of the Soul Music Hall or Soul Music Museum and Stax Records, which is a famous soul music record label. And so we thought, you know, they had everything that we needed to tell the full story, all the elements of it. So
you're driving into Memphis, and you pick a church, and as you mentioned earlier, you had a target city, but then once you got there, it was a little bit more random where you're going to pick. Now, you picked Beale Street because, again, that has some significance of where a lot of these historic Black churches were founded and created and are growing still today. And then you kind of went off the beaten path. And what church did you find to go to?
Well, we ended up finding, I think this was, we found a neighborhood right off of I-40, which is just a little bit north of downtown Memphis. The way Memphis is segregated, a little bit north and a little bit south of the downtown area is predominantly African-American, so the census tracts there are 80, even 90-plus African-American, and then the city east of the city is primarily white. And so we knew, given our interest, that we'd probably be focusing in those neighborhoods a little bit north and maybe a little bit south of downtown, including Beale Street, which is more downtown. And so we ended up finding, and I think it was fairly random, we found a neighborhood that looked like it had a number of churches relatively close to each other, so it would give us some options in case we weren't able to basically get into one. We could, you know, just walk down the block and try another one. And so we ended up finding First Tabernacle, which we thought at the time was a Church of God in Christ congregation. We would later find out that the congregation had recently split from Kojic, that's what we can abbreviate it, and had changed its name to Church of God and Christ instead of in Christ.
Yeah.
We ended up figuring that out later, but still, it was the same type of congregation we were looking for. So,
well, tell us about it. You tell the story about Pastor Cole, who was the lead minister there and his church, and it looked like he gets a congregation of about 50 people attending services. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, well, we actually ended up going to the neighborhood and the congregation that we had kind of randomly, this congregation we randomly selected the day before. So we went on Saturday afternoon just to, I guess, do some scouting, you could say. And so this is a neighborhood that is over 90% Black, and we are two very white guys.
And Roger's very straight-laced. I don't know what you look like, but I know Roger is quintessential guy next door.
Yeah. And so we roll up in our Dodge Charger, and I'm walking around this church that we're scouting out, taking photographs, and there's a neighbor across the street, and he's kind of looking at us suspiciously, and eventually comes over and asks us, you know, can I help you, in a somewhat accusatory tone, which is understandable. I mean, they probably, these segregation lines probably aren't broken that frequently. And so we explained to him that we are interested in attending the worship service, and we asked him if he thought that would be a problem. I guess we were assuming maybe he attended that congregation. And he said, I don't know, you'll have to ask the pastor. And so ultimately we ended up leaving that Saturday and coming back on Sunday for the worship service, and just basically walked in unannounced, and the Bible study was going on before the actual worship service, and we sit down in a pew in the back, and eventually, obviously, we stand out, and eventually the pastor, Robert Cole, who he's a large guy, not horizontally, but vertically. I mean, he's over 6 feet tall and muscular, and he comes back and greets us, and we cautiously ask, "Do you mind if we stick around and maybe take some pictures as you do the worship service?" And he said, "Sure, that's fine." Actually, it was kind of funny that he later told us that that wasn't the first time academics had visited his congregation. That I guess a couple years ago, some contingent from China had actually visited the congregation and videotaped a service. I'm not exactly sure what they were doing, but so anyways, he was used to people visiting and taking pictures and so forth, so that helped.
And so what was the service like?
Well, a few things. It was long. We got there probably about 9:30 in the morning, and the Bible study had already been going on for a while. And I don't think we ended up leaving the congregation maybe till about 1:30 in the afternoon. So it was, it was a long, if you include the Bible study and prayer and all these other elements, it was quite the long service. And the actual service part itself was, well, I should say, before the service, we actually got called back into a men's prayer circle, and we went around, and everyone said what they were, what they would like people to pray for them about, and we introduced ourselves. And obviously, this is our first trip or a first stop, and so we were a little nervous, or at least I was. I guess I can't speak for Roger. And then after that prayer circle, we went back out into the service, and it started off fairly subdued with people providing readings and a couple songs and things like that. But then after that initial maybe 40 minutes or so, the energy really picked up. That Pastor Cole came down, and there was altar calls, which basically congregants or attendees going up to the front, and he's starting to kind of yell in the microphone, and he's dripping sweats, and a very standard kind of Pentecostal black church service where there's this raising of hands, and he was laying of hands on people as he tried to encourage them to live correctly, and sometimes it was specific about people's lives if they were struggling with something. So it was a very energetic main part of the service.
And I assume there's a lot of music too, right?
Yeah. After this kind of altar call part, there was a choir, the choir sang, and there was kind of a band playing and things like that. So yes.
Let me ask you this, because, and we want to move to some of your other places here, so I don't want to spend too much time on this, but what did you take away from this? So you visited this small off-the-road church, congregation probably had 50 people attending that day, very long service. This was back in 2008. You guys come back, you have a chance to reflect upon what you saw as an experience there into the broader context of African-American churches in the United States. And you do that well in your book. So what's your takeaway from this whole experience?
Well, I can speak, I guess, to the service itself or this congregation itself, and then just more generally about Memphis. First, Pastor Cole, after the service, we interviewed him, and he spoke a lot about how the church was, or his congregation was trying to be influential in the neighborhood, trying to mentor the teens in the neighborhood and really try to make a difference. And the fact that the service was relatively, it's relatively long, but still, people in the neighborhood came and attended and hung around and for the prayer circles and so forth, I think really just spoke to, and this is true of a lot of congregations, not just those that are part of the Black Church, but especially for churches in these predominantly African-American neighborhoods, that the church really is a center of the neighborhood. I think the other thing from Memphis, more generally speaking, is we really began to appreciate just how much, when you talk about, you know, a place of faith or religious geography, that you're really not just talking about churches or congregation buildings. You know, when we saw the music on Beale Street, or we saw the Civil Rights Museum, that the influence of a place's religious culture really extends far beyond just the walls of any particular church or congregation. It gets into the food, it gets into some cases the clothing, it gets into the music, and that's something that would repeat itself throughout our trip as we visited other locations. But I think, you know, because Memphis was our first stop, that this is really where it struck us, just kind of what it means for a place to be a place of faith or a unique religious geography, right?
And I think that's a really important lesson to draw, because when we talk about church, we oftentimes think of it as an enclosed, you know, four-wall building that you attend for an hour or two, or in this case, nearly 5 hours. On a Sunday, but you know, the aspect that it does influence the community around it. And you know, the community that church was in was pretty, as you mentioned, was a pretty rough neighborhood. In fact, I think in the book you mentioned that there was a crack house across the street, or formerly was a crack house street.
The pastor explained to us that he described the his neighborhood, this congregation's neighborhood, as rough but getting better. And I think he and the congregation as a whole was really trying to play an active role in making that get better. And I guess I should say his personal biography, one of the first things he explained to us was that he described himself as a former drug addict and thief, and so, but, you know, then someone who became saved, basically, and now he was trying to do the same for the youth in the community and the neighborhood as a whole, so.
Okay, so let's finish up with Memphis, and there's more in the book, and again, I'm going to point people to your book, but we have a lot of territory still to cover here. You get back into the car, and your next stop is Houston. Now, before we get to Southern Texas, I got to ask this. Who did the driving?
We mainly split duties. Sometimes, you know, maybe 2 or 3 hours at a time, someone would start in the morning and then switch off in the afternoon after lunch or something.
Okay, who's the better driver? Now, I won't tell anybody here. It's just between you and me. I won't tell Roger. He's not listening. It's okay.
Well, I have the dubious distinction of being the only one that got pulled over by the police.
No!
I guess, given that, I would have to take the title of worst driver.
Was it speeding or were you?
It was in, I think it was in Iowa, outside of Davenport, Iowa.
Okay.
And I got pulled over this isn't really relevant to the book, but got pulled over because I was supposedly following some semi-truck too closely.
Yeah. You were doing that drafting to save gas. Yeah, I've done that before. Okay. All right, so Roger is the better driver. Okay, very good. So let's get back to Houston. And it is said that everything in Texas is bigger than everywhere else, and this is what you found in Houston. So tell us about big.
Yeah, well, we ought to be, you know, ought to give the listeners a little bit of, sometimes writing a book is messier than it might look in the end, but Houston is a place that we really struggled with in figuring out what did we really want to feature and focus on, because, I mean, Houston is obviously a very large city, and it's a very diverse city. You have a lot of immigrant communities, and so any of those could serve as something to feature in a chapter. But ultimately what we ended up settling on is really this idea of Houston as a kind of religious laboratory, a place where various innovations of different types are flourishing, essentially. And one of the most prominent innovations, religious innovations, that Houston has are megachurches. And indeed, Houston and Texas in general has some of the largest concentration of megachurches. And probably the most famous in Houston is the Lakewood Church that's led by Joel Osteen. And so in the end, we decided that that would be what we would really focus on, was megachurches. But megachurches as a illustration of kind of religious creativity and innovation.
So did you get to meet Joel Osteen? And are his teeth as perfect as they appear on his book covers?
Well, this is I mentioned earlier the risks of not trying to, you know, make interviews and things like that, or schedule things beforehand. And so we actually did not meet Joel Osteen. In fact, the weekend that we were there and attended the service there, he was he was off somewhere. He wasn't there, essentially. I think he was participating in some conference somewhere. And so there was a guest speaker, apparently a relatively well-known megachurch pastor from Australia was giving the sermon that day. But we did see Joel Osteen's brother, who looks strikingly similar to him, although maybe a little older. So,
Well, we've dealt with megachurches several times here on this show, and we'll link to some of the podcasts for folks if they want to investigate this further. But I'm interested in your impression of Lakewood Church and megachurches in general here. I mean, are these things simply vacuous vessels of superficial entertainment couched in religiosity, as they're often portrayed as, or is there something deeper going on here spiritually?
Well, there's no doubt that it is partially, there is an entertainment factor involved. The production values that you could see with the lighting and the soundboards and the cameras and the music and things like that, it really does or did feel like a rock concert, and it is fun. I mean, I think that's part of the appeal, that I'm not a regular churchgoer by any means, but you know, even I thought to myself, like, well, this is fun. This feels like a rock concert. And I think to some extent that there is an appeal there. And I think you probably do, you know, at Lakewood on any particular service, you probably do have some tourist types or onlookers that are just kind of there for the spectacle. But in the end, I don't think the spectacle itself is going to, would sustain a church like that. That, you know, I found it entertaining for one service, but that doesn't mean I'm going to join up. And so the fact that a church like Lakewood is sustaining itself, I think, is evidence to me that it isn't just entertainment, that clearly that there is something genuine going on there. I think, you know, it's somewhere in between your question, that there definitely is an element of entertainment and spectacle, but it's not just that. So.
Now, tell us a little bit about this, because you got pictures of this place, and you talk about the production values and stuff, and you have one of the pictures in here shows the crew that is doing the lights and the audio, and it basically looks like a Sunday night football production center here. And then you have another picture of the auditorium, which was an old sports arena. And I mean, how many people were there?
Well, I think the arena itself holds probably about 15 or so thousand people, and they do several services. And so on a weekend, I think they probably, the total attendance is, especially if Joel Osteen is there, I think it was maybe a little bit down the time we were there because he wasn't giving the sermon. But, you know, they can get in and out 40,000 people roughly in a weekend there with the multiple services. The soundboards and all that kind of thing, I think, could give a person the false impression that this is just kind of some kind of corporate, or maybe corporate's not the right word, but some kind of overly produced event. And it is highly produced, but at the same time, it's driven primarily by a lot of volunteers. That it isn't just that all these people that you see making this possible are highly paid employees or something like that. I think that we were told that the church as a whole only really has about 300 employees, but uses over 5,000 volunteers.
Yeah, you had mentioned that there was something like 600 volunteer ushers that weekend.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
So in many ways it's not different than a small congregation that is very volunteer-driven. I think if you if you did some kind of projection of a small congregation's ratio of paid staff to volunteers and then projected that based off of attendance to a megachurch, it probably wouldn't be tremendously different.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some differences that, given the size of the building, that takes a lot more coordination. We show a picture in the book of the radio room of Lakewood Church, where volunteers are come and check in and get basically a walkie-talkie. And you know, we saw volunteers with kind of earpieces that you see like with Secret Service agents and things like that. So it does take a little bit of different coordination, but still, it's very similar.
Hey, how is parking there? I mean, you got your Dodge Charger, and there's 15,000 people coming and going for a couple different services for a total of 40,000 people. I mean, I have a problem, you know, parking at a Seahawks game or something like that. What'd you find there?
It actually wasn't a problem at all, and I don't know if this is two credits, you know, to the church or if it's just well designed originally. Because I don't think I said this earlier, that Lakewood Church is housed in the former arena for the Houston Rockets, and so I don't know if it's just the Rockets did a very nice design with the parking or what. But it is a little bit surreal at times because in the parking garage, it's, although it has signs about, you know, Lakewood Church, it's very clearly a parking garage, and there's sections and things like that. And so and even in the church itself, you know, even though they've gotten rid of the concession stand materials that would be in there, the food and things like that, but you can still very much see that it was an arena with the different seating sections and rows and things like that. So there is a little bit of a surrealness to the whole thing.
Now, one of the things that we've talked about before with respect to mega churches is that, yeah, you have the Sunday service where you're drawing in the huge crowd, several thousand people. But during the weekday, it breaks down to smaller units. They become federated, so to speak, and they try to leverage a lot of small groups or different Bible study groups, things like that. Did you get a flavor for that at all when you were there?
You see, in the main feature of Lakewood is obviously the sanctuary space, or the arena space, right? But if you actually looked at like a directory of the arena, there's four levels, and each of these levels speaks to a different type of ministry that the congregation is doing, whether it's men's groups or women's groups or youth Sunday schools and things like that. So I think it's easy to only focus on the arena space itself and not see everything else that's going on in this building, and we were told by in our interviews that small groups is a big priority for Lakewood, as it is, as research has shown for many other megachurches. Mm-hmm.
What did this tell you about the American religious landscape? I mean, your previous stop was, you know, African American church of 60, 70 people attending for several hours, and then all of a sudden you go to Houston and kaboom, it's a monster mega church. What'd you take away from this experience?
Well, I think this comes up in other locations as well, but I think one thing about that Houston tells us is just how religion, you know, I think religion is sometimes seen as being conservative, and I don't mean that in a political sense, but in just a stability sense.
Mm-hmm. Traditional, right?
Right, traditional. Yeah. But I think, you know, mega churches and things like parachurch organizations that we explored in Colorado Springs, you know, really get at how adaptable and creative and innovative that the religious groups and religious organizations can be, that that it isn't always just traditional and staying the course, basically.
Mm-hmm. So let's take off from Houston and start driving north. One of your next stops is Colorado. But here's another thing that you do in the book, which I found really fun, that you have your target areas. You're going to go to Memphis, you're going to go to Houston, Colorado Springs. But as you're driving along the way, you'll find stuff on the roadside, and you'll just pull over to do that. And, you know, earlier when you were heading down to Memphis, Tennessee, you saw one in Cumberland, Maryland. But the ones that really interested me were here in Texas, and I assume this is either coming or going from Houston here. There are two places that you stopped at. The first one was a Hispanic Yerbería. Now, what is that?
Well, I guess we have to give some thanks here to Helen Rose Ebaugh at University of Houston, because she kind of gave us some direction about some things we might want to look at while we were in Houston. And she pointed us to the street that had some stores that, you know, sometimes people use the word voodoo or Santeria or things like that. I'm not sure those are sometimes used inaccurately, but basically these stores are a mix of sort of traditional medicine, Catholicism, and traditional religious practices from the Caribbean and Africa and other Latin American nations like Mexico. And so you can go into one of these stores and buy a votive candles, or you can buy various herbs and medicines and things like that. And many of the stores will do rituals, healing rituals, or rituals about good luck and things like that. So,
now, Roger wasn't going off on the side and picking up some magical mushrooms and making this like a Ken Kesey, the Mary Prankster's Magical Mystery Tour, was he?
No, nothing like that.
All right. What did that tell you? I mean, because even though this was a small part of your book, you have these offsets or side notes to the bigger story or the bigger theme of the book. But I found that one to be really interesting. What did stopping at the Yerbería, and as you mentioned, it's a mixture of a lot of different things. Catholicism is there, but yeah, everything else seems to be there as well. What did that tell you about the religious landscape?
Well, I think that many groups are, well, first, I mean, obviously you can't talk about that without talking about immigration. And throughout the book, and it wouldn't be a surprise, I don't think, to anyone, that immigration has played a huge role in shaping America's kind of religious geography. And I think this kind of syncretic practices, you know, blending of different traditions, I think just not to get too stereotypical here, but kind of gets at this melting pot theme of the U.S., that you have a lot of different groups, and they blend different things. Although, I should say that obviously things like Santeria or voodoo didn't originate necessarily in the U.S.
So. Mm-hmm. But it becomes just part of the overall general mix of things. And as you mentioned, you know, Houston, yeah, you think big and you think of the mega churches and Joel Osteen and things like that. But, you know, again, you got this small storefront. And again, you have a really great picture of it, and not only the outside, but the inside of it. And, you know, it's a small place. It's a little niche. It shows the diversity of America and the, you know, the basically the pluralism, the religious pluralism that makes this country very religiously vibrant.
Right. Yeah.
The other side trip that you made in Texas was to a cowboy church. Now, you know, regular listeners will know that I am a big fan of cowboy churches. I've been to several, and we even featured a cowboy preacher, Daniel Stiles, on the show. And it's one of my favorite all-time interviews. You can find it up at the top of the webpage. What was your impression of the cowboy church? Actually, your first impression was very Wild West stereotypical. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I, you know, in short, I thought, well, first I should say that, you know, the cowboy church was one of these things that truly was just something we ran across that I think we stayed in Amarillo overnight, because, you know, getting from Houston to Colorado Springs is pretty far.
It's a long drive, yeah.
We needed a stopping point. And I think that morning before we hit the road again, we just said, oh, I think actually we found it on the GPS, showed up on a list of churches on the GPS, and we were like, oh, we should just really go and see what this is. And so we just stopped in, and I really wish that we had maybe actually featured it more or spent more time there, because really all we did was walk in, and there was someone there, thankfully, that could speak with us, but we weren't able to experience like the service itself. And what was interesting about this church is that behind the church they actually had an arena where they had rodeos, weekly rodeos as part of the church, and the youth there was a separate building for the youth group, and that was sort of cowboy themed as well. So yeah, it was a really interesting church that I wish we probably could have done more with. So.
Yeah, you mentioned it, though, as you pulled in, a tumbleweed blew across the entrance gate. So.
I tried to get a picture. I did get a picture of that, but it wasn't very good. I mean, trying to time the tumbleweed going across.
You should have had Roger go back and then toss it across and everything. Yeah, but yeah, it's a sad that you didn't actually get to see the service. And again, for those of you listeners who are interested in cowboy churches, we have a great interview with Dan Stiles that we'll link to on our website. And I'm a big partisan of these. Maybe someday I'll just do a road trip of cowboy churches, because one of the things that I pulled from that experience, both attending them and talking with them, is that America is somewhat of a frontier nation, and we have people who are transient, not meaning in the homeless sense, but they move around a lot. And it's that kind of church that really caters to this, rodeo guys who are making the circuit every summer and fall. And you have to deal with those kind of folks who need to basically satisfy their religious desires and stuff. So
yeah, there's although cowboy churches are somewhat unique, there are some parallels with trucker ministries, mm-hmm. and things like that truck stops that have some kind of church in them for the truckers that go in and out.
So. Yeah, and speaking of truck stops, where'd you guys eat? Were you guys eating at fancy 5-star restaurants, or are you pulling over at the Dairy Queen and stuff?
No, I think Subway probably should have been another sponsor of the trip. Probably much to Roger's dismay, I'm actually a vegetarian, so that made finding food difficult at times, especially just off the highway, because most fast food places aren't exactly vegetarian friendly.
Yeah, no, you pull into a Flying J truck stop and order a arugula pita sandwich, they're going to stare at you, man.
Yeah, so Subway ended up being the only option for many, many, many stops for food. So.
All right. Next stop, as you said, Colorado Springs, home of the U.S. Air Force Academy, numerous churches, but more importantly, what you pull from this area is that it is the site of many parachurch organizations. So what is a parachurch organization, and what did you find in Sea Springs?
Yeah, well, Colorado Springs has been called, I think a Time magazine article labeled it the Vatican of evangelicalism. But if you look at things like church adherence rates and adherence, what percent of the population belongs to an evangelical church, I guess it's somewhat high, but calling it the Vatican of evangelicalism is a little odd, because it's not as high as it would be like in the South or something like that. But the real reason why it's given that title is because it's the home of, it's really, the Silicon Valley of these so-called parachurch organizations, and that's P-A-R-A. So,
mm-hmm.
And really, what they are in reality are nonprofit organizations, primarily evangelical Christian nonprofit organizations, that are doing a great variety of things. Some of them are doing humanitarian work. Some of them are doing publishing and translation work. Some of them are working on social or political issues. Some of them are doing sort of missionary work or missionary support, and so it's really hard to put a single activity or label on these organizations, but they do all share this status of being a nonprofit organization that isn't really tied to any specific congregation or even any specific denomination.
And what were some of the ones that you stopped and visited?
Well, I think one of the more interesting ones, I guess as a sociologist, was an organization called Global Mapping International.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a missionary supports organization, but I say as a sociologist it's interesting because really they were, for the most part, academics, not necessarily PhD sociologists or whatever, but they were doing data, they were producing data and maps for missionary organizations. So they were basically consultants for other organizations. So we went in there, and they're doing a lot of things that I might do to understand religion in the U.S., looking at spreadsheets and producing maps and things like that. So that was pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, it's neat because I've used their data in previous studies that I have done.
Yeah, okay.
And it's really, kind of good. I don't know if they're hooked up with the ARDA or not, but maybe they are now. I don't know.
No, I don't think they are, actually, although okay. They probably should be. So.
Yeah, everybody should be. All right. So who else did you visit?
Let me see if I can give it a different example. We stopped in at one of the most famous examples of a parachurch organization, Colorado Springs, is focused on the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably, you know, if you had to think of a flagship parachurch organization in Colorado Springs, that would probably be the one. And they have a very large, I think it's safe to say, a campus almost of multiple buildings in Colorado Springs. In fact, it's such a destination, tourist destination, that it has its own kind of exit sign on the highway that we took a picture of and showed in the book. We also stopped in at Compassion International, which is a very large humanitarian, it's a child sponsorship primarily organization. One of our most interesting ones was we sat down to meet with one organization, and they ended up saying, oh, well, have you spoken with the group that's across the hall? And we didn't really even know that there was. This is kind of the amazing thing about Colorado Springs is that you can't really throw a rock without running into another organization. That every block has at least a couple of these headquarters of a nonprofit organization. So we ended up walking down the hall, and there was an organization that had rented out the garage or basically the warehouse of this original organization we're talking to, and this Impact for Life Ministries is, and they were mainly doing publishing for prisoners. So they would send boxes of Christian books and, in some cases, tapes and videos and things like that to prison. So that was an interesting one.
So what does this all tell you about American religiosity? Because these aren't churches. These aren't organizations where somebody shows up on Sunday and there's a sermon and, you know, the kind of stereotypical way we view churches. What did you take away from this experience?
Well, I think there's a lot of talk about parachurch organizations being new somehow, and that's partially true, at least. But it's not new in the sense that religious groups haven't been doing these things all along. That if you look in the 19th century, that there was lots of Bible and Bible publishing and missionary organizations and Bible tract societies and things like that. And really what you're seeing is just a reorganization of these activities that religious groups have long done, that you're seeing with the increase of non-denominational individuals and congregations that aren't tied necessarily to some denomination, and some denominations, say, missionary work or some denominations' publications, that opens up this kind of market niche for these non-denominational parachurch nonprofit organizations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. And they act as many, in many ways, support groups for the other churches that all are around and stuff.
Right, right.
Yeah. All right, so let's get back into the car. You've been driving a while, and you probably have discovered here, going from Texas to Colorado and now heading out west, that in the west here, the roads are much, much longer, and the space between cities is much, much greater. So what kept you entertained on these long drives? Are you guys listening to the stereo, talking? What were you doing? Tuning into farm radio there?
Well, you know, when you're doing this for 5 or 6 weeks, you know, you start off, at first you don't like the silences and you think that they need to be filled, and I think eventually you just accept that, well, if you're spending this much time in a car, that you don't really have to be entertained every minute of the day. So but yeah, we would find radio, and we had a MP3 player. And
okay, so what does Roger listen to? Because he's kind of an old guy. You're the younger generation. Are you guys having arguments on whether you're gonna, you know, listen to Leonard Skinner or Golden Earrings, Radar Love, a classic, you know, road song, or you looking for Foster the People and stuff?
Well, personally, I'm more of kind of a hard rock metal person.
Oh, okay.
But Roger does, you know, it's, I don't think he would go for Metallica or
yeah, no, he's not
Machine or anything like that. So somehow we ended up settling on a lot of Creedence Clearwater Revival. I'm not sure why. I guess that appealed to me and him. So
okay.
I remember listening to a lot of that. So.
Okay. Now, the next chapter in your book, you go to California and San Francisco, and I just recently learned in a interchange with you that this wasn't part of the driving trip, but you came back to this later when you attended a conference. nonetheless, you sequence it in the book as following Colorado Springs. And I think it's kind of interesting here. You know, California, it's the state that represented the American dream back in the 1950s. You target San Francisco, the city by the bay that's both known for its immigrant population and also its celebration of nonconformity. So, and you get a little bit of both of those in this chapter. Let's start with the immigrant part of the equation first. Your focus in San Francisco was to examine the Asian immigrant scene. So what'd you find there?
Well, yeah, San Francisco has been and is a major port of entry of Asian religions, particularly Buddhism and Taoism. First with Chinese population and then Japanese population. And you see this, I mean, the most obvious place where you can see this is in San Francisco's Chinatown. And it was really, this is, I think, one of my favorite cities because it was, I think, maybe because it was just so new to me, but it's pretty amazing in Chinatown where you would have basically just a door on the street, and if you went up three flights of stairs, there was this really ornate, beautiful temple, essentially. So, but then throughout the rest of the city, you also have other congregations, and we learned an interesting story about, and you see this in other places as well with immigrants, but what role persecution played for these groups. Particularly, we spoke with several Japanese congregations that where they told us still about the internment camps during World War II, and that was still very real event in their lives, right?
And how does religion play into all this here? I mean, are these folks converting to Christianity? Are they bringing their Asian religions with them? What'd you find?
Well, with the Japanese immigrants, they have sort of an interesting story that a lot of the Japanese congregations, Buddhist congregations in San Francisco, are organized with the Buddhist Churches of America, which is basically kind of a denomination, and they. As I just said, they referred themselves as churches, Buddhist Churches of America, and that was an attempt after World War II to try to at least appear like they are assimilating a little bit more. And if you go in their church, although the altar, the front part is very different, there's still pews, and so it looks very different. So for the Japanese population, the process has been fairly different than from the Chinese population in Chinatown, in particular, where you still have very traditional temples that don't look particularly different than what you might find in China.
And another story that you tell here, and this is kind of one of the side notes, is the role of Hare Krishna. And so, you know, we're not talking your trip is just standard American religion. We're talking some of the more, you know, maybe offbeat religions. Hare Krishna was a big attraction in San Francisco in the 1960s. What? Tell us about that story.
Yeah, this was another sort of spur-of-the-moment visit where, so San Francisco has always been, or not just even San Francisco, but California in general, has often been a site of new religious movements, and so we wanted to try to at least get some of that in the book. And so one day we just randomly stopped in a Hare Krishna congregation, and as we did in most places, just kind of walked up and said, "Hey, can we talk to you for a little while?" And we ended up finding one woman who was an American convert, and she was more than willing to tell us all about Hare Krishna. And interestingly, she described herself as still a Christian and said that she still maintained a lot of Christian practices and didn't see belonging to Hare Krishna as being exclusive of being Christian. That basically Hare Krishna or Krishna is just another name for God, and so if, whether it's Christ or Krishna or whatever it may be, it's all the same, right?
Yeah. So why did she convert? Did she give you any reasons why?
Trying to think back of what I remember, she told us at some point about an ex-husband who who I think had some drinking problems or other issues, and I think maybe joining Hare Krishna served as some kind of some outlet for living a more cleaner life. I believe that was her biography.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what was the takeaway from San Francisco? What does San Francisco religious scene, the immigrant scene, tell us more about America's religious landscape in general?
Well, I'm probably starting to get to repeating myself a little bit here, but I think one thing is just how much religion seeps into other elements of society and culture, that it's not just about the churches. So, you know, when people think about drinking Zen tea or doing yoga and all these other sorts of things, I mean, at one point in time, these terms and practices were part of a religious tradition or a religious community. And the other thing, I mean, in terms of Hare Krishna and the other kind of new religious movements that are prominent in California and San Francisco, is just, I think, reiterates how much the U.S. is sort of this free market. I think that's, you know, that's kind of the term academics have been using of religion. And because it's this free market, it really provides room for creativity and new groups to appear.
Mm-hmm. And we're running a little short on time, and you travel through a number of other places, central Nebraska, you travel through and you talk about this big, huge statue of the Virgin Mary that's on the border between Nebraska and Wyoming, which is an interesting pit stop as you go along the way. I want to finish off with two other unique religious traditions here that you find in the United States, and if you could briefly kind of give us your overview here. You stopped in Detroit and investigated Muslims in America, and then later on, in a separate visit that wasn't actually part of the road trip, you headed out to Bronx to look at Orthodox Jews. So tell us what you found about those two types of faiths and how they fit into the American religious landscape.
Sure. Well, in terms of Detroit, there's a lot of interest and attention in the media lately to sort of the increasing numbers of non-Christian groups, including Muslims in the U.S. But what's interesting about Detroit is that not only does it have one of the largest populations of Muslims in the U.S., but it's also one of the most diverse and one of the oldest, that the Muslim population in Detroit isn't just a recent phenomenon. It's not just the past decade or 20 years, that it really stretches back to the early 20th century. As immigrants from Yemen and some other Arab nations came to the U.S., and they were motivated partially by, in any migration there's push and pull factors, but part of the pull to Detroit, like for everyone else in the U.S., was the economic opportunities, and many of them did end up working in the car industry, like, for instance, Ford has been a prominent employer of Muslims in the U.S. and still is to this today. And there's been several different waves of immigration, Muslim immigration to the U.S. from various nations. So if you look at the Muslim population in Detroit, that it's about a third Arab of, you know, whether it's Lebanese, Yemenis, and other nations, and it's about a third South Asian, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and so forth, and then the rest are a mix of Albanian, Bosnian, and a few other nations of origin. And so it's a interesting city, thinking about sort of diversity in the U.S., or particularly around Muslims.
Now, one of the interesting things with many of these immigrant communities is, you know, you figure, well, why would they end up in Detroit? And oftentimes there's random reasons, a pull of the auto industry that's getting started or something. But once a immigrant community gets planted somewhere, it tends to attract other immigrants because, you know, the culture's already there. You have your mosques, you have your other cultural institutions that come up, and so you attract more. One of the questions I have, and this has been a question that people have been asking in the media in general, is, you know, to what extent do groups like this assimilate to American society? And, you know, especially considering September 11th, there's been a great deal of concern about the Muslim population here in the United States. People are perhaps growing more concerned about it or something. What did you pull from this? Do you see that the Muslims are becoming cloistered in their area? Do they feel embattled? Are they starting to assimilate? What was the sense you got?
Well, when we approached Detroit, I think the first road trip, Detroit was our last stop, and I think as we got closer to it, we were really concerned that it would be difficult to get in these congregations. It would be difficult to get people to talk to us, partially for the reasons that you're talking about, that maybe there would be suspicions. But in reality, it was probably one of the easiest places for us to talk to people. And I think, looking back on it now, it makes sense, because I think many of the congregations and their leaders really wanted to show that, look, we are Americans and we aren't terrorists or we aren't scary or anything like that. And so when they saw us and we wanted to tell their story, I think they were more than happy to talk to us. And so even though we had this fear about it being difficult to speak with people there, that was really misguided in the end, because it was one of the easiest places for us to get access, essentially.
Mm-hmm. In many ways, it tells the story again of the immigrant population to the United States, bringing cultures, how it affects the general culture in the populace. And again, there's this tension between, as you mentioned before, the melting pot of full assimilation versus the analogy that's often used, a salad bowl, where people want to retain some of their cultural heritage. So you picked up that tension?
Yeah, well, we know from research on immigrant religion that frequently immigrants may not become Christians in that sense of assimilation, but they do assimilate in taking a lot of sort of American religious structures. And I think we saw that in many of the Islamic congregations that we saw there, that even though, back in Yemen or wherever it may be, that a mosque could really just be a place of prayer. It didn't need to be a place where there were youth groups, and it didn't need to be a place where there was education and kitchens to hold community dinners and things like that. And so a lot of immigrant communities, when they come to the U.S., they form a much more congregational culture, kind of the standard American voluntary congregation that is more than just a place to have religious services. And many of the people we spoke to mentioned this in Detroit about how it's not really just a mosque; it's an Islamic center. It's not just a place of prayer. It's much more than that.
Mm-hmm. And let's finish off with the Bronx. And what'd you find there? Orthodox Jews. That's, we've talked about evangelical Christians. We've talked about the Asian religions. We've talked about Muslims here. Now, another big component of the United States religious landscape is Judaism. What'd you find in the Bronx? Or Brooklyn, I should say.
Right, Brooklyn. Well, I think what's interesting about Brooklyn is, or New York in general, is that I think a lot of people assume that New York is the last place that you would see this very traditional religious community that is where the religion is really saturating the community. I think most people, they think of Broadway or financial industry and things like that for New York, a very secular place. But in Brooklyn, you have this community that is living among this very urban scene, but maintaining a very different lifestyle and a very saturated lifestyle with their religion and how that affects the neighborhoods that they're in. And so the most prominent part of this is the Hasidic communities in Brooklyn, and they're concentrated mainly in Brooklyn, where you see whole neighborhoods that are basically businesses and synagogues and basically, the whole neighborhood is a Hasidic community.
Right? Yeah, and so, but here's the interesting thing, because Orthodox Jews, they're forming that community, and so obviously that's going to permeate that exact community there. But as we talked about Memphis, the African American churches have really kind of permeated our culture much more broadly. Did you see that in the case of Orthodox Judaism, or is it still a relatively cloistered part of American landscape?
I would say that it was still fairly, I mean, obviously if you're walking around the neighborhoods, you can see, you can shop in the stores or the restaurants and things like that. But the community itself struck me as much more still a closed community. And I think, you know, that's by design. I think, like many other groups, say the Amish or something like that, that they view themselves as they need to stay separate, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And again, part of the American landscape. It's not only pluralism and diversity and the blending of things, but there's also ways that you can carve out your own niche and find your place that you want to be. The freedom that we allow allows for that as well.
Yeah, I mean, one sign or one symbol of that is, like, in Brooklyn, you have separate ambulance services and separate, obviously separate schools and separate busing services and things like that that are run by the Jewish communities, more specifically the Orthodox community. And these are all institutions or services that allow them to maintain this separateness, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So this long trip, 5 weeks, you've been traveling all around the place, and you know, you head home. You took an airplane trip out to San Francisco, you did Brooklyn, and you did a few other side trips. But reflecting back on the entirety of this trip, what one thing, the most important thing that you could say you got from this whole experience, what would you learn the most?
Well, I think it made me really appreciate that, and this is going to sound like a paradox, but that American religion is really incredibly diverse, and we try to show that in the book, but at the same time, it's also incredibly similar from place to place. And what I mean by that is that, the mosque in Detroit is very different than the mega church in Houston, and that's very different than the Buddhist church or temple in San Francisco and so forth. But really, the functions and the concerns and the activities and goals and hopes of these different communities and congregations are really quite the same. That our trip took place during the early summertime when a lot of schools are being let out for the summer and so forth. And we heard in Detroit, in Memphis, in Nebraska, we heard in all these diverse places basically the same kind of messages about keeping, kids busy or keeping kids out of trouble during the summers and so forth, from pastors and other people that were part of these diverse congregations. I think it's interesting that it's easy to look, I don't want to get too like Pollyanna here, but I think it's easy to get too distracted by the diversity and not see a lot of the similarities across communities.
I think that's true. I mean, that's from my experiences and studying this over many decades. That's one of the takeaways I see. And the way that you got through this fun-filled road trip, which we didn't cover all of it. And so I recommend again to our listeners, pick up this book, Places of Faith, A Road Trip Across America's Religious Landscape. It's got stuff on Mormons in Utah and here. It's got Nebraska and a bunch of other little small pit stops along the way that I think would be really great. And I just want to ask you, if you're ever planning to do this again, can I come along?
Sure.
Okay, because one thing I'd love to do is the rural churches out here in the West. I'm a West Coast kind of guy, and so we have some interesting religious features out here in Washington, even though it's a pretty secular place. But again, I encourage people to pick up your book, Places of Faith, A Road Trip Across America's Religious Landscape by Chris Scheidel and Roger Finke. Chris, it's been great having you on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.